May it please the Court, Cheryl Gordon-McLeod on behalf of Kalani Lu'i. I'd like to try to get to two related issues, if I can, this morning. The first one is the exclusion of the defendant, the defendant's counsel, and the public from the hearing on whether to disqualify his original lawyer, all because of a conflict with supposed government witness Wu. And the other issue, the related issue, is the Crawford error, because the government never ended up calling supposed government witness Wu. With regard to the first issue, the secret hearing that was conducted on January 25th of 2008, this is one that was prompted by public defender Ms. Byrne's motion to withdraw. There is no dispute that this hearing was completely closed, closed to the public. The government acknowledges that a family member was escorted out of the courtroom. The court reporter says the courtroom was cleared. It was closed to the defendant, and it was closed to anybody representing the defendant. And I say that knowing that a first assistant from the Federal Public Defender's Office did go into the conference, but I think it's clear under Wadsworth, under Adelzo Gonzalez, and even under the Bradley case, that it doesn't matter if there's a lawyer in there who's not representing the defendant's own interests. That's not the defendant's lawyer. And in this case, the first assistant public defender was not representing Mr. Lee's desire that his lawyer stay on the case.
Now, what is the right of Mr. Lee? He's being represented by a public defender or someone he's not able to choose and pay for his own counsel. So if the counsel that has been working with him and has been appointed 6 months before the trial says, I've got to withdraw because I have a conflict, how much more is the defendant entitled to know, and is he entitled to keep her as his attorney if she wants to depart?
Well, I agree with your premise, no right to appointed counsel of choice. But the indigent certainly has a right to counsel, and the first complaint is that he was denied the right to counsel at this in-chambers hearing, just like in Wadsworth.
But I guess I'm asking, what rights could he have asserted there?
The right that he could have asserted there was the right to, well, there's three rights that I want to talk about that a lawyer could have helped him with. The first would have been to advise him about the nature of the waiver so that Mr. Lee could have made a decision about whether he wanted to waive it. The second, and given this record from Mr. Kalani Lee saying, I trust this lawyer, she's helped me in the past, it's detrimental to my case to take her off, what he could have done was sought to waive the conflict. And I say that it's a waivable conflict based on, I think it was the Lewis versus Maley case, which specifically said that this is a waivable conflict. Representation of a conflicted witness can be waived, but it has to be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
So it's kind of impossible to be knowing and intelligent if he's not going to be told what the problem is, and it's apparent he's not going to be told what the problem is for some pretty good reasons.
Well, I just...
He's never asked to waive. I mean, you're presuming here that he has the right to waive. Is there anything that tells us he has the right to insist upon waiver? That the lawyer can't say, look, I got a conflict. I'm not representing you anymore.
Yes, in answer to all of your questions. First of all, let's make clear that the lawyer, his own lawyer, Ms. Byrne, never said, I don't want to represent you. She said, the first assistant told her that I can't.
In the same office, and that's not her decision.
Well, the conflict.
I have lots of lawyers in my old law firm that are happy to say, I want to keep representing. And the firm has to say, no, we've got a conflict. That's true for the Office of the Federal Defender, too.
Absolutely. But the Federal Defender also has a duty under Lewis versus Maley to describe to the defendant the nature of the conflict so that the defendant can make a knowing and intelligent decision.
Now, your premise is that the defendant has a decision to make.
Yes.
What tells me that the decision is in the hands of the defendant?
What tells you the decision is in the hands of the defendant is this. In Lewis v. Smaley, that's a Ninth Circuit case from 2004, that was a case concerning waiver of prior representation of a witness and the only suspect in the case. Now, the court held in that case that the waiver of counsel was not sufficient because there was not enough information given to the defendant to knowingly waive the conflict. The necessary corollary
is... That's a problem, though.
Well, the necessary corollary is that if the defendant is given sufficient information and the defendant reasserts, this is my trusted lawyer, then he is entitled to have the district court judge exercise discretion. He doesn't have an unqualified right to keep...
How is that a necessary corollary?
Well, Lewis v. Smaley said that there is a right to waive the conflict of prior representation.
Well, no, it said in that case that the waiver wasn't effective. That doesn't mean that there's necessarily always a right to waive.
Well, it says that the waiver was not effective because it didn't meet the knowing, intelligent, and voluntary constitutional waiver standard.
That still doesn't say anything as to you about an absolute right to waive.
I don't assert that there is an absolute right to waive. I understand that under Wheat, there's discretion about whether the judge has to accept the waiver. The defendant can certainly say, I waive it. The district court judge can say, in my exercise of discretion, like in Holloway versus Arkansas, it's just too tough, we can't do it. The judge in this case didn't exercise any discretion. First thing that happened is that the judge in open court said, conflict? Okay, you've got to be off the case. The government attorney said...
Well, a magistrate judge who routinely appoints counsel can probably figure out what it means when the federal defender comes in and says, we've got a conflict. And one of the supervising the attorneys comes in and says, we've got a conflict, Judge.
Okay, the government was the party that...
What's the magistrate judge likely to think?
The government was the party that stood up and said, I think we need a little bit more than this on the record. And that was why they went into chambers. The only party that was represented was the government attorney. The government, the first assistant said, look, there's this cooperating witness. Now, what was the big secret about not telling the defendant about it? The cooperating witness was Boo. Boo was on the tape. Boo did the transactions with Carice Stewart. Boo is the one who's in my opening briefs all over the place. Boo was listed on the government's... Boo was assumed to be a witness before they decided not to call him. There's no big secret. There's nothing about Boo cooperating that couldn't have been told to the defendant. The fact that it was as a result of a deal made with somebody that the Federal Public Defender's Office was representing was reflected in the plea agreement. Plea agreements are presumptively open unless there's a reason for sealing them from the public. If there was a reason for sealing this, then all they needed to do was not say what the name of the represented party was. But there was no big secret that needed to be kept from the public, the press, the family, or Mr. Lee, because the fact of Boo being a supposed witness was known to everybody. So he certainly could have been told about it. A lawyer could have advised him about the conflict, could have argued in favor of waiver at this hearing, and a lawyer could have called out the government on its assertion that Boo is a necessary witness, because as it turns out, about 3 months later, the government comes in and says, oh, we've decided we're not going to call Boo as a witness. We're simply going to rely on the tapes. So a lawyer, I think, had a large role to play in this and could have changed the outcome by advising, by asserting the waiver, by getting the judge to exercise discretion, and by pulling out the facts about whether Boo was really this necessary of a witness or whether this was not exactly the case.
In a few minutes, you're going to tell us that Boo was a necessary witness.
I just think you're spending a lot of time on a losing issue.
Well, let me move to a winning issue then.
What?
Let me move to a winning issue.
You already wasted half your time.
Take a shot.
Crawford. I'm going to take a shot at Crawford, which is the first issue in the opening brief. Crawford, of course, bars admission of a non-testifying informant's statements at trial. Boo was the informant, and it was his tape statements that were introduced at trial, and they were tape statements that implicated Mr. Lee. Now, the cases seem to divide the universe up into tape statements that are not testimonial because they're limited to supply and context, tape statements that are testimonial because they're more than establishing context. Here we've got the tape statements of Boo about at least 8 different taped exhibits, and Carice Stewart is the one who's testifying about them. Stewart, for example, says, well, Boo said, give me, quote, something, and he meant, quote, crystal meth. Carice says Booth said, quote, more better just let me talk to him, close quotes, and that him meant Kalani Lee. And this is true for each of the 8 different exhibits, tapes that she goes through. She keeps saying what Boo meant when he said stuff, and each time it was crystal meth. And she keeps saying what Boo meant when he said, let me talk to him, I want to talk to him directly, and that that was Kalani Lee. Now, there is no other... Let me talk about the evidence that was established. On the whole, we have a bunch of evidence that Boo and Carice Stewart had hand-to-hand transactions. There was videos, there was the drugs, and there was the money from these transactions. None of that establishes that Mr. Lee was the source of the methamphetamine. Certainly there's circumstantial evidence that it was him. There's a license plate, and there's his presence at the Ala Moana Shopping Center. But no direct evidence. The only direct evidence that linked Mr. Lee to this was the statements from Ms. Stewart, who took the stand, and Boo Kabuag, who did not take the stand. Now let's look at Ms. Stewart. She was the jilted lover. She was the informant. She was the one who was carrying the grudge because she saw Mr. Lee.
I don't know if she was jilted.
The record shows that she was in treatment and that she saw Mr. Lee out with other women while she couldn't do that because she was stuck in treatment, and there was testimony that there was some bitterness because of that. Boo is entirely different. His statements were contemporaneous with the sales. He was the one who named Kalani Lee as the supplier when Ms. Stewart would never use his name on the phone. He was the one who said crystal meth on the phone where Ms. Stewart would never use that. He was the one who did the specifics on the phone because Ms. Stewart would never use the specifics. Boo's testimony, Boo's non-testimony, his statements, fall into a completely different category than the only other direct evidence of Ms. Stewart. And that is how the government used it. In closing argument, the government, and I'm referring here to excerpts of record 216 and 217. In closing,
tell us why that tape was inadmissible.
The tape was inadmissible because it contained statements from Boo, a cooperating government witness, and those statements implicated Kalani Lee. He used Kalani Lee's name, and he said, that's where I want to get my crystal meth from. It's like the cop saying, I got the 911 call, and instead of thereafter saying, as a result of the call, I did such and such, the cop says, and the 911 call said that so-and-so committed the murder and I should go check it out. It specifically identified Kalani Lee by name as the supplier of the crystal meth. And there was nothing else that did that directly other than Ms. Stewart's testimony. So I think the impact was great, and I think it was used as substantive evidence.
Didn't Lee talk to Al on the phone?
There was one conversation at Ala Moana with Lee talking to Al on the phone and asking for his money after Stewart threw the methamphetamine into the car. Again, yes, that exists. It is not the direct evidence of a hand-to-hand sale that we have with Stewart and Boo. It's her explanation of what that meant and Boo's explanation.
Did Al see the two of them drive up together?
Yes, there was certainly, and there was a license plate number with Lee on it at a different transaction. There was definitely circumstantial evidence. The Boo out-of-court testimony, though, was direct evidence, and I think it's in a different category. I'm running low on my time. I will reserve some.
Sure.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a question. The transcript with Boo, that went in, on what basis? What rule in the federal rules of evidence?
A rule that allowed a co-conspirator's statement into evidence, and those were co-conspirator's statements by Carice Stewart, a party to the conspiracy
with a defendant to distribute and possess with intent to distribute methamphetamine, Your Honor.
But, of course, Boo was not a co-conspirator.
That's correct. And it was not. And Boo's statements were not offered as a co-conspirator exception to the hearsay rule. They were offered, as I offered, as verbal acts, that is, offers to purchase methamphetamine from Stewart. And then her statements were offered and as non-hearsay co-conspirator statements, and Boo's statements, as recognized by the district court, were simply as statements that were made in context.
They were made in context, but they also contained direct damning evidence of Lee.
I don't think any. I submit to the court that the statements that Boo made were in put Stewart, the co-conspirator statements, her replies, into context, and that Boo's statements, I submit to the court, never mentioned Kalee. They would ask questions about he, and then the questions that were asked of Stewart were proper questions. Who do you understand?
What's the rule that says you can bring all this stuff in to show context?
The two cases that are cited is...
Where's the rule?
I suppose it is a case law that allows, but I'm not sure, so sure there is a rule that directly addresses that, Your Honor. It's case law that allows the court.
Yeah, they used to be in the old days when we took evidence in law school. Sometimes some schools you don't have to even take evidence. And Professor McBain used to sort of smile about it, but they had this rule of res gestae. If it's res gestae, it comes in. If it isn't, it goes out. But that rule was discredited 60 years ago.
Well, it's not raised in...
I know, that's because no one really worries much about evidence anymore.
There is support for allowing the statements of Boo in, or an informant, in the nature of providing context to the replies of a co-conspirator. That's the Whitting case that's mentioned, this court's case. There's also, I believe, a Seventh Circuit case that we mentioned. The Whitman case, I'm sorry, and the United States versus York case that we mentioned, which is a Seventh Circuit 2009 case, and the defendant admits this. Appellant concedes these matters. They argue that it was not. Our position is we never argued it improperly. We never argued Boo's statements improperly. And this is a confrontation clause. If there is an issue or if there's...
For what purpose did you offer it?
We offered it as verbal acts. That's what we argued. And the court recognized that it was statements that were simply made and provided, put it in context of the replies of Kalee Stewart, the co-conspirator's statement. And then that was admissible. We disagree with the petitioner's argument, appellant's argument, that we argued it improperly. There is nothing in the record to show we did not argue it improperly. They argue that the government, in closing argument, made some reference to Boo's statements. We did not reference Boo's statements. We referenced that the case against the defendant was overwhelming, that there was a lot more, is what we argued, besides Ms. Stewart's testimony. And in fact, there was. And the court is well aware. There was a surveillance tape.
Well, then you didn't need all this stuff anyway.
I believe we do.
Why?
Well,
it was overwhelming evidence.
Well, there was evidence besides.
Why didn't you bring Boo on and have him testify?
It was a decision that was made that he would not be a good witness necessarily, Your Honor. He'd been involved in unauthorized during the time he was assisting the FBI. He bought methamphetamine. He did not advise the FBI of that. He went back and bought methamphetamine and smoked methamphetamine with Ms. Stewart on one of the nights of the deal. That was in late November of 2006. And it was believed that it was best to present the case.
So he could have been badly impeached.
He could have been impeached. Yeah. So was Ms. Stewart impeached.
You protected him from impeachment.
No, we thought it was just best to present the case with a tactical decision to present the case without two individuals that could have been impeached. We had Ms. Stewart. She was subject to impeachment as to prior bad acts, as to a prior conviction, as to a belief that she would lessen her sentence this way. There was substantial impeachment to her. And the defendant did testify. And he was apparently not believable. The jury was free not to believe him. And apparently they didn't. The case that we had showed a defendant and a cooperating individual that was recorded. The cooperating individual referred to the defendant by Kalani. I disagree with the statements of counsel that there was no mention of the defendant. The defendant's name was mentioned. She called him Kalani. And we would ask her when she testified, who did you mean when you were referring to Kalani, or who did you refer to? In fact, Judge Gilmore asked her, when you say Kalani and you mean the defendant, who are you referring to, and would you please say when you say he, who you mean for the record when you're referring to? And she mentioned it. It was Kalani Lee, the defendant. There were cell phone records that showed Kalani Lee was contacted immediately after Carice Stewart was talking with the informant. Carice Stewart talked to the informant on December 20th and said, I'll have to check to see if he has the drugs ready for tomorrow. And when she got off the phone, by her cell phone records, when she got off the phone with Boo, the cooperating individual, the next call she made was to the defendant. That was on December 20th. And the next day was the deal at the Alamoana Shopping Center parking lot, where the defendant was seen driving Ms. Stewart in a rental car to the meeting, dropped her off, circled her around, told her to get back in the car, and sped off. And then got on the telephone, Carice Stewart's telephone, with the undercover officer, Deputy Sheriff Burt Akana, who was known as Al, was playing the role of an off-island drug buyer, and said, the defendant said to Al, I'm holding you responsible for the payment. So there was the defendant speaking with Al. He was seen not only by Al, but by a number of surveillance agents in the parking lot. Then he was seen bringing Ms. Stewart back later in the afternoon to collect the money, because they owed, I think it was $18,000 for the several ounces of methamphetamine they supplied. And then prior to that, there was also another cell phone contact in November 21st, I believe, where the defendant was meeting with the undercover with the cooperating individual and did a drug deal, had received money from the cooperating individual, left the presence of the cooperating individual, drove to her home, and as the way driving to her home, she called the defendant's cell phone from her cell phone. We have those cell phone records and submitted those into evidence. Yeah. So
you didn't really need that thing.
My notes to myself are that Exhibit 6, in that Boo specifically named Lee. Now, am I wrong about that?
I can't question that, Judge. I don't question that if your notes say that. Exhibit 6 was a telephone call on November 29th. That may have been a reference to him, Your Honor. I don't contest that. If that's in the record, I don't have it in front of me.
Are you asserting that this was harmless error?
Yes.
And what objections were made to the introduction of these exhibits?
There was an initial objection to the introduction of the tape, and in particular as to Boone's statements on the tape. That was argued before the district court. We mentioned, as I've mentioned here before, our position that the statements of the co-conspirator exception brought in Stewart, Carice Stewart's part of the tape, and that Boone's statements on the tape were not offered for the truth of the matter asserted, and the judge recognized that, questioned Mr. Ishibashi, defense counsel, on that, and said, well, they're not really offered for the truth. Isn't he playing a role, and isn't this just the fact that he made these statements? And we argued it was a verbal act, and the court mentioned that it was to sort of put it in the context, the fact that they were...
It was a verbal act. It was offered for the... It was offered as positive evidence.
It was offered that they were interested...
It's a verbal act that's offered as positive evidence. It's not impeachment.
It was offered to show that the United States through this informant, was acting to buy or interested in buying drugs. And the fact that then, of course, that this was brought out, it was brought out by the defense in the cross-examination of the FBI agent early on in the case, long before any tapes were played, that Boone had reported to the FBI that he believed or that the defendant was distributing drugs. That's why we argued this was harmless error. This was raised initially by the defense in a cross-examination of the case agent, FBI agent Justin Stern. That information was elicited by the defense attorney. We did not make the argument as to the statements of Boo being offered as truthful or for the matter asserted that the defendant was involved in drug dealing, that the defendant was a drug dealer, that the defendant was assisting or helping Ms. Stewart deliver drugs and distribute drugs. We never made that argument. We didn't make that argument in our closing argument. We never offered it for that. The court recognized it for that. And it was simply, as we said, context for what was the replies made by Ms. Stewart when she met with Boo and Boo was asking if there were drugs available. That's our position, as it's harmless error.
When you decided not to call Boo, it seems to me there should have been a lot of government head scratching as to whether you should put those exhibits in or try to put them in.
Our belief was at the time, Your Honor, that the status of the law allowed us, the case law allowed us, that it didn't violate the confrontation clause. The way we were offering them and the way we handled them in court, it is still our position that did not. It was a tactical decision. That's correct, Your Honor. I'd like to just respond briefly to the argument of
Boo on your witness list?
Initially he was, and we told the defense we were not going to call him.
When did you tell that?
It was before the pretrial conference, before the judge, Your Honor, before Judge Gilmore. We told Mr. Ishibashi we were doing that. We were not going to call him. I'd like to proceed a little bit mention a little bit about the waiver issue. Our position is that there was a conflict that the federal public defender had, that Mr. Silbert, the first assistant federal public defender, explained that to the court, that the record was developed in that fashion, that they actively represented another individual that was seeking to get credit on behalf of another person who was providing information, that is Boo, against defendant Lee, that they couldn't have stayed on in that case, that it is clear, we submit to the court, that the magistrate judge realized there was a conflict, and that it was apparent to the judge that the defendant wanted to keep Ms. Byrne as his attorney, and that it was the court inquired into that. The court realized, saying it was a clear case of a conflict, claiming it was a slam dunk, and that the court was not required to have a waiver. And it's clear the defendant would have waived if they brought him in. To say that there's an automatic reversal in citing the Holloway case and the Alberni case, we submit those cases are distinguishable from our particular situation. Here there was clearly an error. A conflict. It was a conflict that was apparent to all, and while the court did not bring the defendant in and ask for a waiver, those cases do not support the argument that it was automatic reversal in this case.
When all was said and done, there was no money to pay for a lawyer. All the money that they made selling all this stuff, they didn't have anything left to hire a lawyer. They had to go to the public defender's office.
A public defender did defend Mr. Leahy, Your Honor.
Yeah.
That's correct.
But they had no money.
We don't, of course, see the affidavits that defendants file when they seek appointed counsel. Those are sealed. We don't see those. His brother, Henry Lee E., was, I believe, represented also by a CJA, a court-appointed attorney, not the Federal Public Defender's Office, but a court-appointed attorney.
Well, they just want the best representation, so they want the Public Defender's Office.
They had an aggressive... Ms. Byrne is an aggressive attorney, as is Mr. Ishibashi. I suppose I'm going outside the record, but to answer the court's question, they did have, our belief is, good counsel, competent counsel.
Okay.
Thank you. I'll submit, Your Honor, unless there are further questions. Thank you.
Your Honor, in response to some of the court's questions, it's the government's burden to prove that the Crawford error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And we've submitted case law saying it's not harmless if there's any possibility that the jury could have relied on it. Exhibit 6 was the one, and this is in the excerpts of record at 311 to 316, where Stewart, in talking about Exhibit 6, that's where Boo wanted to trade the Heineken beer sign for a half an ounce. Stewart said, no, he's not going to want to do it. But Boo said, yeah, have Kalani take the sign. And on the stand, Stewart said that when Boo said that he wanted to trade it for half an ounce, Boo meant crystal meth. The government did argue this in closing.
Was that really a serious dispute? And I understood the question was who the identity of the other person was. When you're talking about half an ounce, you're probably not talking about gold. I mean, is it really disputed as to whether it was an unlawful substance that was being discussed?
I've listened to a lot of these tapes, and it's probably not really disputed, but the government always has to prove it. If they say five plums, they mean 5 ounces or whatever.
It's hard to interpret.
Identity is key.
Is there anybody else hanging around who's called Kalani?
There was another Kalani, which is the reason that Judge Gilmore said on the record to Carice Stewart, could you please specify which Kalani you're talking about? Is it Kalani Lee or is it the other Kalani? I did want to invite your attention to excerpts of record pages 216 to 17, which is where the government did argue about Boo's statements in its closing argument. They said, quote, Boo's talking about, ellipsis, you got nothing, stuff, drugs, close quote. So they were, that's the sentence that they used, and in the context of the whole argument, they are arguing Boo's statements as substantive evidence. In addition, it was admitted as substantive evidence. The jury didn't get to hear the niceties of this argument, it was just for context. The jury heard that Stewart said, that Boo said that Kalani Lee was the man to go to for the meth, and that's where he wanted to get it from. I think the government's concession that the reason that they ended up not calling Boo is because he was a government... Oh, I guess this is counting up now. I apologize.
That's okay.
It's because he was not going to be a good witness. That's what Crawford is all about. The Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause allows defense counsel to confront those guys who are not going to be good government witnesses. So I think the government has failed in its task of convincing this court that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Thank you, Your Honor.
I've begun to think that when these tapes, they tape up the informant, that this is testimonial because it's intended to be made and presented in court.
Precisely. Just like the Melendez-Diaz case talked about, this is something prepared specifically in anticipation of litigation, in anticipation of catching who they think is the crook, and it is providing, if it were providing context, then Ms. Stewart could have just testified from the stand, I agreed that I would get methamphetamine, and I decided to go to Kailani Lee to do it. You wouldn't need Boo's statements at all. The reason that they introduced it and the reason that they identified Boo as naming Kalani Lee is because he was the second bit of direct evidence linking him to the crime. Thank you, Your Honor.
That matter is submitted. And we'll go on to the next matter. Which is
next page.
Next page. Mark H. versus Patricia Hamamoto et al.